This is File 22, Cycle 2. Today's date is March 16th. This is Jean McMillan. I am interviewing Ron Jones on a number of things, probably Beckley Furness and his book Ethan and John and Salisbury Association, the Library Board, anything else he wants to talk about. But first we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
Jones.
And your birth date?
I was born on January 2nd, 1930, in Oneida, New York. I was the first baby of the year.
Oh, but congratulations!
I don't remember much about it.
Oh, all right. Your parents' names?
They were Keith W. Jones and Winnie T. Jones.
Was the Winnie spelled with one N or two?
Two N's. Short for Gwendolyn.
Yeah, but she liked Winnie.
Yeah.
Siblings? Brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had an older brother, 18 years older than I am, and two sisters, one 16 years older and one 10 years older. I sort of grew up as an only child.
I can understand that. What is your educational background after high school?
After high school, I went to Yale University. Graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in 1951. In the fall of that year, I attended Navy OCS in Newport, was commissioned an ensign, and after serving 3.5 years, I went to Harvard Law School and received my JD, or LLB as it was in those days, in 1958.
Well done. That's a good background.
Yeah.
How did you come to this area?
There's several things that brought me to this area. Actually, I grew up in central New York, and going back and forth between New Haven and central New York took me through this area, so I had some early baptism. And I had friends who were up here, and we visited friends up here and decided this was a very nice place to come and possibly settle down. That was way back in 1980.
Yes, I remember well. I remember well. Because you were my neighbor then.
That's right.
Out on Route 41.
Yep.
Or Torrey Hill, as it was called at that
yes.
time. When did you develop an interest in local history and iron industry?
Well, it came about, actually, because I heard I attended a meeting of local people involved with history, and specifically the iron industry. And more specifically, the construction of the blast furnace in Lakeville in 1762. It was to become later the Arsenal of the Revolution, producing cannons for the army. And I was told that it was built by Ethan Allen, known to everyone, and the Forbes brothers over in Canaan. And they were quite well known in the iron world. They had some forges. And somebody nobody knew anything about, a man named John Hazeltine from Massachusetts. Well, it turned out, as I checked back, that John Hazeltine was my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather.
How many greats was that?
One of my many great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been very important in the iron industry over in eastern Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And indeed, he was the one who actually, to all my understanding, built the 1762 furnace here. He and his son built the 1762 furnace.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that whetted my interest in the iron industry, and as part of all that developing with the Tri-Corners History Council. That Tri-Corners History was a group formed within the Salisbury Association to try to coordinate local history in the different towns. And I was asked to go develop some educational markers for the Beckley Furnace in its area. And I did so. And as I finished the marker and went over to the Beckley Furnace, standing there with Fred Hall and Tony Cantelli of the State Environmental Protection people, the state owns the furnace.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at the furnace and it was crumbling. It was ready to fall down. And we decided that it didn't do much good to have an educational marker.
When there wasn't anything to see.
Just on a bunch of stones, yes. So with that, we formed the Committee to Preserve the Beckley Furnace and started pressuring or doing all we could do to get the state to act. And that involved really trying to get more interest in the area about the old iron industry. And we had a number of events. The culminating one was a Valentine's Day pancake breakfast held out of doors in Dr. Adams' fields over by the furnace. The temperature was 9 degrees above zero. 125 people came to that event, including our legislators.
Good.
And the next Friday, the state authorized $250,000 to preserve the furnace.
Those must have been wonderful pancakes.
Oh, they were great pancakes, and we always felt that the legislators went back to Hartford and said, these people are not going to stop with anything. You might as well give them the money. And anyway, that next 2 years, the furnace was refurbished, and our committee, to give it more lasting structure, I incorporated the thing as the Friends of the Beckley Furnace. And that group continues today to provide signage and events and all sorts of things, brochures and other materials, all involving the Beckley Furnace and the whole iron industry in this whole region.
When did the state give you the $250,000?
I think it was 1998.
All right. How about the Beckley Furnace Heritage Trail? When did that come into being?
Well, what we did with the Beckley Furnace, we first of all worked with the furnace, but then developed, Ed Kirby was instrumental in this, and others. We developed an Iron Heritage Trail looking around at different iron sites. There was a site of an old furnace in Sharon, and one in Cornwall. And
was it like a drive-yourself brochure?
Yeah, and so I prepared the first of several brochures about an Iron Heritage Trail. And since then, there have been better ones with real pictures.
Different ones, not necessarily better, but different ones. About the same year, 1998, Tuesdays at 6 came about.
Yeah, very quickly. The Beckley Furnace is in East Canaan, and that sort of tied in with the Falls Village Canaan Historical Society through a bit of circumstances. I ended up as president of the Historical Society that owned an old 1804 meeting house in South Canaan. And that was rather bad shape, but we got that meeting house fixed up and then thought it'd be nice to bring people into the meeting house. So I had the idea that if we had summer programs, Tuesdays at 6 o'clock, that finished up by 7 o'clock, or we would bring people in to see it. And those started, I think, in 1999, and in a different form, they're still continuing today.
They're excellent programs.
Well, they draw, this area has so much talent and so many people that what I did, I worked with Mary Lou Purcell over there. She sort of took it over after I started the thing. But we just would look around at all the people who had interesting things to talk about. Mm-hmm. Some of them were local, some of them were national, some of them were ancient history.
Yeah.
It covered a wide, we had several Yale professors come up here and speak at our programs. So the idea was to make interesting programs every Tuesday evening in the summer so that people would just think, gee, it's Tuesday evening, maybe I better go to the meeting house.
And it's a nice place to meet because it's central. And the hour is a good time because that's about all you can sit on those hard pews.
That's right. No, I made sure. Matter of fact, Fred Hall was one of our wonderful speakers.
Oh, yes.
He was a town historian over there. And Fred would love to get into a subject, and I'd have to stand at the back of the audience and waving my hands to him to let him know it was time to stop and let the people off. And let them go have dinner.
You had a system.
Yeah.
Now, you talked about the Salisbury Association Tri-Corner History Council. When did that start?
I think that started around 1995, 96. Whitney North Seymour Jr. was the one who started it, and he thought that the local historical interests in the different towns should be talking with each other. And it was really just a group of bringing people together, compare their plans, and see how they could knit together.
Ah, all right. So it was a regional thing rather than individuals.
It was a regional thing. And the combination of those two, I'll just jump into it, the combination of the Tri-Corners History Council, operating out of the Salisbury Association, and our Iron Heritage Trail, focused at Beckley, led to the concept of maybe this area, the Housatonic Valley, Upper Housatonic Valley, could be designated as a National Heritage Area. And Mike Seymour went to Washington and talked with some people who said, yes, it's a good idea. We'll support you if you can start doing it. So then he asked me if I would take it over and do everything required to become designated.
And you did.
And we did. It began in year 2000 when Congress passed the law asking the Park Service to study the area and see if we met the criteria. Mm-hmm. And the Park Service did over the next several years and came out with reports saying, yes, indeed, we do meet the criteria. We have a very special history. We're a beautiful area. Scenic beauty is wonderful. And we have some very interesting people here. So the area from Kent, Connecticut to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, along the Housatonic, was designated as a National Heritage Area in 2006. And it's prospering today.
Oh yes, absolutely. The Salisbury Association, when did you, if you've fallen into a lot of history, but when did you get involved with the Salisbury Association? Was it through the Tri-Corner History Council?
It started through the Tri-Corners History Council. And then at the millennium, in the year 2000, or probably 1999, Salisbury formed a number of committees to look at the future of Salisbury. And one was a history committee, and I was chairman of that committee. And I worked with Bill Morrill and others to see what shape, what we should have here, because Salisbury did not have a historical society at that point. It had several, it had the Oral Histories Program, and it had the Holly Williams House, and it had a few other things, but they were just sort of generally under the Salisbury Association. And Bill and I decided we should have a historical society where the emphasis was on doing things.
Yes, what's your motto?
We are what we do.
Excellent.
It appeared on all of my documents. We are a group of active people, and it took to about 2008 for that to come to fruition. And the Holly Williams House was sold.
That was sold in June of 2010.
Okay, well, it was on the process of being sold. I moved it forward a little bit. But in 2008, the Historical Society was set up as a separate committee, basically, under the Salisbury Association. And I headed it from that point until January of 2015. And it had a number of really hard workers, talented workers, that lived up to the thing, the motto that we are what we do.
Are you pleased with the way it's developed?
Yes, very much so. Indeed, when I gave up the chairmanship or whatever it is, leadership, it was I recognized that it was ready for the society to take another step, to really grow, become bigger, and become more involved, become just more sophisticated, and that's exactly the path we've taken under Lou Bucherri.
He's done a fine job.
Yes.
And it has expanded in a number of different areas from where it started. I mean, like a flower. It started in a bud, and now it's beginning to leaf out.
Well, one thing, Connecticut, the state of Connecticut, has a number of coordinating organizations.
Oh, yes.
And what this is doing is sort of bringing us into that loop to draw upon.
Yes, but I don't want to be homogenized either.
Yeah.
We are an individual town, and we are very special, and would hate to lose our individual characteristics.
I think that's fair to say that that's a feeling of many people, but it harks way back to revolutionary times,
mm-hmm.
when this area was called by some the 14th colony, because we had a thriving iron business and other, you know, farmers and everything. Our population, I think, was the highest
then.
Population of Litchfield County was the highest of any county other than Hartford. I guess Hartford
mm-hmm.
was slightly
ahead, bigger,
but just about the same size. And that the people up here had very little tie to Hartford.
Or we still
Southwestern Massachusetts, they had very little tie to Boston. And so it was called the 14th Colony, something over here by itself. When I explained this, being up here with very little tie to Hartford or Boston, to our legislators, Andy Rohrbach and Roberta, they said, "Ron, nothing has changed."
That's true. That's true. Where did your book come in, Ethan and John?
Well, this goes back to my realization that John Hazeltine was the man behind building the furnace. There's no mention of it in our family records about John Hazeltine. It noted he was an active, ran several iron companies in eastern Massachusetts. He settled and incorporated the town of Upton, Massachusetts.
Oh, yes, I know that well.
And he also incorporated the town of Townsend up
in
what is now Vermont.
Okay.
And that was part of the New Hampshire grants.
Mm-hmm.
So. But it had no mention of his coming to Salisbury. But tracking through, I see when he did come to Salisbury and work out the arrangement to build the furnace, and he sent his oldest son, because his various sons were active with him in his ironworks, he sent his oldest son here to supervise and to run the furnace for the first several years.
Where was that furnace located?
Right down in, was it the Holly...
Holly Sport, Place.
Holly Place.
By the what is now Thacketon. Okay.
Lake Lanskapoma.
Yep, by Factory Pond.
And it was right there, that's where the furnace was.
Okay.
And nobody in all the histories of Salisbury was aware of the role of Hazeltine because they did not know anything about him.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we have Ethan, the 23-year-old Ethan Allen, designing and building a glass furnace and such things. But he did this, and his son Paul, who's also he's my great-great-great-great-grandfather, stayed in this area for several years. He lived in Lakeville, there's a record where he lived. And then he went on to Vermont to follow his father. Ethan Allen, also at a later time, went on to Vermont. And my book has a number of the ties in Vermont history where Ethan Allen and John Hazeltine coordinated fending off the New Yorkers who were following up on the King's decree that actually what is now Vermont belonged to New York.
Oh,
and
yes.
All these people had their grants from New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The history of Vermont is very interesting, but no one had picked up, the Vermont historians never realized when they were writing about John Hazeltine that he had been a partner of Ethan Allen, and that's why he ends up at a number of Ethan Allen meetings and different things. So there's a coordination. I wrote the book with the hope that some Vermont historian would want to take it and do some more research
and
come up with a real book. But in the meantime, my book is John and Ethan.
And when was it published?
Published in 2008.
You are a busy man. You are a busy man.
And it is for sale at the Salisbury Association.
Good point.
And at the library.
Yes, absolutely. We've got to put this plug in when we can. What are your hopes for the future for the Historical Society?
I hope it does well, and I really don't want my thoughts as to where it should go to get mixed up too much. I'm very happy to have it
in other hands going.
And all the people who are involved with it today, I wish them well.
We need all the help we can get.
Yeah.
Anything that you'd like to add to this interview of the various things that we've discussed?
Well, one quick little thing. I also served from 2006 to 2008 as president of the library, Scoville Library.
Good.
And I think it was 2010 that I put together the program to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the Scoville Library's earlier versions of its being the first publicly funded library in the United States. And it grew out of a children's library.
Yeah.
And also grew out of the library of a man who owned a blast furnace during the Revolutionary War and went off to England. But he...
Richard Smith.
And we had a nice program where I spoke and covered the history. And
it was well received.
Tony Scoville talked and bringing some of the family side of it and how Scoville's and Jim Dresser talked a bit about Old Salisbury.
Oh, yes.
And the publicly funded aspect.
And I have a young lady from the University of Massachusetts that's doing her thesis on youth libraries of the United States, and she was blown away by the fact that we still had some of the Richard Smith books.
Oh, yes. Yes, they're up there.
Well, oh, yes.
And the library's closed right now, but they're up there on the...
They're up there in the tower.
Yeah.
Along with some of the Caleb Bingham books.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time and your information.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I always enjoy talking with you. And I congratulate you on the success of the oral histories, because they really are an asset to the community.
Thank you so much.